he sort of had some parallel existences going between his day job in education and sports education and working with youngsters in the capacities that he did, and what he did by night, which was inhabiting one of the most unique characters that we've ever seen and ever will see in this business. Jim Myers is the man who breathed life into the one and only George the Animal Steel, and it is a pleasure to have him on the program here tonight. Jim, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. It's a privilege to have you on. How are you?
Hey! You want to talk to Jim or George?
Either one's good. I definitely want to get some out-of-character stuff. You tell me what order you want to do it in.
I really don't care.
Well, I tell you what, let's make a gym at least for a while, because certainly that part is, it would be, I guess, a novelty to go either way here, but to hear you out of character is really something that people don't get a chance to do or even envision, because you inhabited a character that, as one of our previous hours guests referred to it as, you know, basically trying to take almost like a modern-day take, I guess, on the Neanderthal and everything that you were doing with that, while in real life being, an educator, very successful sports coach. That's a dichotomy that's probably wider than most people have, even when they have some form of a parallel existence.
It's been wild, it's been fun, and it's been crazy. But, you know, God was in control all the way.
Well,
I never was in control.
And you know, further evidence of that is the fact that, again, this was something that basically happened over time, correct? You were already on the path for your career as an educator, and essentially with the Pittsburgh territory, you ended up, I guess, first as the student and then morphing into your character.
Well, what happened really, I started teaching in 1962. Actually, 61, I got out of Michigan State University. My knee was blown. I was basically a football player, and that's where my interests were. And with a bad knee, the NFL at that time, I had signed with the AFL, but that was out of the question. And I was teaching for $4,300 a year. I was not a wrestling fan. I never even watched it, to be honest with you. And it all happened just by a lark, I guess. But I was looking for a job as a bouncer in a bar to make the ends meet. I had two children, a third one on the way. I was making $4,300 a year teaching, and that wasn't going to cut it. And the contract I signed with the Buffalo Bills back then, the first year of the AFL, was huge. It was $8,500. So that will give you an idea of the difference in the money and what it is now. Guys are making millions of dollars playing pro football. But the bottom line is, after 1 year of just wrestling around the Detroit area with a mask on, wrestling as a student, I made around $18,000-$19,000, which was big money, because no one in the NFL was making that kind of money. So it kind of worked out pretty good, and it was all about the money with me early on. And in fact, I thought that when they started showing me how the business worked and that it was a bit of a show, it was I took it as a insult to my integrity as an athlete. But as I learned the business and learned how to work, I found it to be much more intriguing than the real deal of maybe being a pro athlete.
And essentially, if I'm understanding correctly here, you were having to balance seasonally over the years, were you not? You mean you had your teaching schedule that you were locked into, and then, of course, all teachers have got their summers to themselves here. But for at least a long time, it was a balancing act for you, was it not?
Well, it started out really crazy because, again, I started teaching in the Detroit area, and in 1962 I started wrestling as a student, and no, it was all going on at the same time. I would get up at 7:30 in the morning, go to teach, then coach afterwards, be done at 6:30, jump in a car and drive to Grand Rapids, which is 180 miles away, or sometimes a shorter trip, and then get back home around 2:30. And then started off. So I was getting 5 or 6 hours asleep and going 6 days a week. On the Saturdays, I would wrestle in Detroit TV, Grand Rapids TV, then come back to Jackson, Michigan TV, and then wrestle a house show after that. So it was really relentless. And all this time I was teaching. I didn't start the balancing act until 1968, really. And that's when I went into the WWWF, the whole Northeast. The year before that, I went into Pittsburgh, and that's where I got the name George Steele, because I didn't want to, you know, use my real name, Jim Myers. Mm-hmm. And somebody suggested it was a Steel City, so that was easy. So half my body is only 42 years old. That's pretty neat.
The WWF time, yeah, that, I guess that's the time that was sticking in my head. That's the time I was thinking of there. So you were not available to the old, well, WWF, as you said, back in the day. You were not available to them on a year-round basis. So is that when it became more of a balancing act schedule-wise?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And it really worked out to be a real strong positive, because I could go in there in 3 months and wrestle. At first it was Bruno Sammartino, then later it was Pedro Morales, then later it was Bobby Backlund. I could go in and wrestle the champion in every major town in the Northeast and be gone in 2.5 months and make more money than most of the guys are making wrestling there all year.
See, that's very...
But I was getting all the main events.
That's interesting to me, because it was that was a little bit before when I was as a kid able to follow wrestling. I was familiar with like the tail end of that period of time there. It really was the era when you could have the special attractions. I know Andre did a lot of traveling. I know down south they had. I remember reading about Roughhouse Fargo, who would go to Memphis for like 2 weeks a year. He was doing like an asylum gimmick, and they'd bring him in as a special attraction. There was just stuff that they could do then when the business wasn't exposed, I suppose, that you never could do today when everybody knows everybody's business.
Well, we were in different territories, so what you would do is you'd work one territory, and then when that wore out for you, move on to the next. So there was always a place for guys to go. There was a big, big demand. The money was pretty decent, really, for the times. And it was just a carnival-type atmosphere. It was great. You could be working 8-10 months, let's say, in the Nashville area. The next 8 or 9 months, you might be in Minneapolis or California or wherever. You could travel around from territory to territory. The negative part of it was you was always moving to your family. And yep. A lot of the guys were married. A lot of the marriages didn't last very long. I was blessed. I've been married to a saint for 54 years, but I wasn't moving all over the country. I always had a home base. I'd go into, let's say, the New York area, the Northeast, for 2.5 months. My family would come out and spend a few weeks with me. And basically, I was just traveling up down the coast with guys like Fuji and some wild, crazy people. It was like a totally different lifestyle from teaching and coaching, which was kind of neat.
Oh, yeah. It really had to give you a lot of different variety in your life as far as experiences go. Maybe more variety than most people tend to see in a lifetime.
Maybe more variety than what you really would want, because the lifestyle of wrestling and the lifestyle of teaching and coaching was totally at opposite ends of the spectrum. So I would go in 2.5 months and try to do everything that everybody else was doing in a year, you know, all the full-time wrestlers, and then I would sneak back and hide in the gym and be a teacher and a coach. So it was really kind of neat.
Oh, I can imagine.
It was a great experience.
Yeah, really like a double life kind of a thing, especially, again, when the business really wasn't exposed. Now, again, I was mentioning in terms of my perspective, again, as sort of, you know, a child of the 80s and somebody who lived in the Midwest my entire life, I really didn't get to see any of your work until essentially the national expansion was going on. That was the tail end of your run, the last couple of years with the WWF. And I've been interested to see, and through the wonders of YouTube, all kinds of archival footage is out there. The character that we remember that probably in most people's mind defines your career, the latter career type stuff, the interviews where you were conveying more, probably 10 times more facially and everything like that than you were with any actual words or phrases or whatever. But the interviews that you had given earlier in your career, and I'd like to see if this is true what they're saying on Wikipedia, that Vince Jr., when he did take over the promotion there, tried to move you towards more of that Neanderthal type direction. Was that really the case in trying to get rid of any trace of eloquence from the interviews?
Well, it was crazy because, first of all, when I first went to the Northeast, I was the only heel or bad guy that did my own interviews, and I did them very articulately. I mean, I was good. Mm-hmm. My egos aside, I was good at it. Mm-hmm. And when we went to the other direction, I call that the cartoon character, cartoon character. And the part of my career that I liked the best was the wild heel character that I was early on when I first went to the Northeast. Everybody hated me. They would throw things at me, and it was great. I loved it. And then when we went to that cartoon character, people started to love me a little bit and felt sorry for me and made me a lot of money. So, you understand, I like that part of it. Mm-hmm. I live in Cocoa Beach right now on the ocean. I have a great lifestyle thanks to that hey, character shorts, the animal seal. But in my heart, I was a much better heel early on, and I was much better doing my own interviews. But well, the idea, one of the ideas that we had to break away from me doing my own interviews was because I was only in the Northeast for 2.5 months and I had to go back and teach. They'd had to get me a manager so they'd cover for me while I was gone. They could keep my name good because, and the reason they did that wasn't because I was a good guy. It was because I was selling out all the towns. Mm-hmm. It just, and the fact that I wasn't there for a long time, 2.5 months, kept the mystique going. And I'd like to say that I was doing better because they wasn't around so much.
Well,
if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
All supply and demand, you know.
Oh, sure, and I guess wrestling's probably like any other creative business. You know, we've had musicians on the show who've spoken of the conflict sometimes between commercial and creative pressures, so it makes a lot of sense that you would say that something that you liked the best on the artistic level wasn't necessarily the thing to put the most money in your pocket.
That's exactly right, and, you know, the thing, you bring up the arts. Back when before the business changed, now it's pretty much predetermined. All the finishes were always predetermined, but they worked the match out from the beginning to the end. Back when we did all that in the ring, and we called it. It was really an art, a psychology of the crowd, and it was an art that was able to develop, and it was really a challenge. And you know, a dummy couldn't do it. Let's put it that way.
Oh, no, definitely not. And I want to ask you also, too, one of the things people think about when they talk about that part of your career, that defining part that was the most commercially successful for you, big part of that merchandise, big part of that the mind puppet. What were the origins of that? Do you still have any of those suckers laying around the house as souvenirs? What's the story behind that?
That's the craziest story probably in my career, and very few people think to ask it. Do you remember Hillbilly Jim?
Yeah.
Okay, Hillbilly Jim used to travel with a unstuffed animal. He called it, you could buy him in the store, but it's Earl the Dead Cat. I had never seen one of them. And we were talking one day, and I went into his room, and he had thrown this Earl the Dead Cat out. He said, "This is my traveling partner," and I laughed at it. It was a flat cat like it had been run over by a car, with the tail was squared off, and the eyes were crossed. I said, "Oh, I got to have that. I got to use it today." We were doing TV, so I took Earl the Dead Cat with me. I put it behind my back, and Mean Gene was interviewing me, and I kept going, "Earl!" Earl, and he was asking me about my opponent, what I was going to go and do. And I kept saying, "Earl, Earl!" And I pulled out this cat right at the end to crack him up more than anything else. I said, "Dead Cat." In other words, my opponent was going to be Earl the Dead Cat. And when Vince saw that, he died laughing. But then he come to me, he said, "Why are we selling somebody else's product?" He said, "Why don't you develop your own action figure or doll or whatever you want to call it, stuffed animal, and we'll sell it." So I designed the mind doll myself. I had the Velcro on it, and I was getting late in, you know, my career. So we had Velcro on the hands, and I could put it over the ropes and lock the Velcro together. And as we wrestled, and if some of the guys would hit the ropes, the mind doll would swing back and forth. And then I would have them, after I'd beat them up a little bit, and I'd have them get mad at me. And this is really crazy, off the wall, but it worked. It was very creative, I think. They would take the action, or they'd take the mind doll off the ropes and stomp it. And when they stomped it, I would act like they were stomping me. Then they'd kick it, and I would act like they were kicking me, and I'd get angry. Then I'd beat the tar out of them. And then when I won, I'd have the referee hold the mind doll hand. A hand up in the air for victory, and they really became a hot item. And that was just before I got sick with Crohn's.
Okay.
And that was the end of my career, really. But the mind doll was a good part of my retirement money, to be honest with you.
I can believe it. I mean, people obviously think about that, and they also think of the green tongue and the turnbuckle biting. Are either of the stories behind those ones as great as the mind doll story?
I think they're all great because they all happened by accident. Nothing was ever, you know, we never sit down and said, "Okay, this is what George the Animal Steel is going to do or be."
Mm-hmm.
The green tongue is very, that was really scientifically developed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah.
I'd had a few drinks one night. I didn't want the promoters to know it was a TV show, and I threw some Clorets in my mouth and went out, you know, in front of them, and then I went out on the live television and stuck my tongue out, and it was green, and the place went crazy. And They put up signs the following show in Pittsburgh. They had green tongues hanging all over the place, and I thought that was kind of funny. And I did it again about 4 months later just for my own entertainment, and the place went nuts again. So after that, I had the best breath in all of wrestling, and it wasn't real creative, but it did work. And then turnbuckle pads. I was in Pittsburgh, and this was black and white TV, and they used to give away different gifts to get people to come to the studio wrestling. And this one particular time, they gave away those satin couch pillows, kind of tight pillows. Mm-hmm. You probably don't remember them, but this was more in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And this one lady got mad at me and threw her pillow at me. You know, I got a pillow in the ring, an opponent on live TV. What am I going to do?
Uh-huh.
I sit on it. It's going to be boring. If I throw it back, there's another 300 pillows out there. They're going to bomb me with pillows. So I bite it, and I rip it apart, and this pillow was packed so tight it exploded. And the stuffing is coming down, and I've got it. Now what am I going to do? So I take the pillow, and I put it over my opponent's head, and I'm choking him.
Mm-hmm.
Great TV until I pull the pillow off, and he was blue because the foam in the pillow was lighter than air, and every time he took a breath, and it was going down his lungs, it almost killed him.
Ooh.
So when I go to the dressing room, the guys are all laughing, and one of the guys said, maybe you could get somebody to throw a pillow at you every night. That'd be pretty good, very entertaining. And Tony Pugliese said, maybe you could eat the turnbuckle. And everybody laughed. And about 2 weeks later, I was working with the Chief J. Strongbow, and the match just wasn't working like we'd like it to. So I looked over to turnbuckle, and I thought, I wonder, turnbuckle pad. And I went over and took a bite out of his old Everlast pad. It tore like paper. And I took that out, started rubbing the Chief's head, then ran his head into the corner, and we had a riot. From a very boring match, we had a riot. So from then on, I decided, well, I could run around, act like a real character, and have a green tongue and eat turnbuckles. They wouldn't have to wrestle that much.
Like most great things in life, George, it can come through trial and error, you know, with the George the Animal Steel character there, Jim. There's no question about that. But what I'd like to ask you about also here, too, of course, and people can find at www.georgesteel.com at your website.
George the Animal Steel. I just changed that a little bit. I still have that. You can still get there by George Steel.
Oh, okay.
But you got to go through a different site. Just www.georgetheanimalsteel.com.
Gotcha. Well,
I had a funny thing happen there today, too.
Really?
Or yesterday. I have a message board, and somebody came on and I said, who's going to live the longest, George or Jim?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you know, when it's time, God will have us both walk away into the sunset together. Somebody else comes back and said, no. George Steele will live a lot longer than Jim Myers because of the DVDs and the the video games and the action figures and all that stuff. So I thought about it. They might be right, but in reality, we'll probably both go together.
Yeah, I guess it depends on if you mean it literally or figuratively. Literally,
exactly.
Literally, you both go at the same time, and God willing, that'll be quite a distance down the road. But I want to ask you again, because what I like about what's on your site and what you are about personally is trying to, you know, be about positivity, put a good message out there for people. You've been very good about sharing your testimony with people in recent years, your faith, or maybe it's just semantics. To me, I call it awareness. Your awareness, I think, of how things really work. I'm curious to know from your point of view, because to be in this business, you have to be able to withstand a lot, and you've had a lot of, I'm sure, heartache over the years in just looking around at stuff with all of your colleagues who are no longer with us here, whether it be Elizabeth, who you worked with very memorably back then, or anybody else over time here. How has your faith, your awareness, essentially, that you've had in recent years, that you've really been great about sharing with people, how does that help you be able to get through some of this stuff, and what can it inform other people about how to deal with sadness about what happens to their heroes?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of misconceptions about the deaths in wrestling, and there's been over 60 of them in the last 5 years with people under the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty dramatic. And you got to say why. And right away, the media jumps on it, and they say, well, it's steroid use. And yes, the guys do use a lot of steroids. You can see that in the bodybuilding. But that's not the case. Michael Jackson just died from the same cause of most of the deaths in pro wrestling, and that is very simple, pain pills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very strenuous business, and you get injured a lot in wrestling, and the guys carry bags of pain pills with them. They used to, and I think they still do. I'm not around it like I used to be, but I'm sure of that. Mm-hmm. And you take a few pain pills and add booze to it, and you've got instant death. And, you know, it's going on with our youth today. And these are all pharmaceutically prescribed pain pills. So, but that part, it drives me crazy. My faith is, has changed my whole outlook on everything. If you go to my website, you'll see that I was born with a learning disability. Mm-hmm. Way back when they didn't know what dyslexic was. And I didn't know how to read or write, going through high school even. I got into college, and I had a professor that recognized that I had some basic intelligence, and he set it up so I could take a lot of my tests orally. So that's how I got through Michigan State. It was not a walk in the park, and it wasn't because I was a football player. Just God had the right guy in the right place for me at the right time. And from there, you know, Michigan State, teaching and coaching. I'm still having a learning problem. I'm teaching kids. But I'd gone with kids with a challenge. I had a great opportunity to work with them. I still didn't know that I was dyslexic. I didn't know that until I was 50 years old. But I knew that something was wrong, and I knew that something was working right. And kids with problems, instead of going to the counselors, would come down to the coach's office, both boys and girls. So, you know, that worked out pretty good. Then the teaching, the wrestling, it opened up a whole new avenue of life for me, a different lifestyle. And I walked on the evil side of the business for a long time, so I understood that part of it. And then, you know, as time went on and I retired and I had Crohn's disease and the health challenges taught me a lot, I had an opportunity to be in a few movies and quite a few commercials, which was a great experience. All this developed my testimony.
8:30.
Jim Myers, people would care less about Jim Myers, the old coach, because after you've coached a while, you became, you know, and you've retired, they call him, oh, what's his name, the coach. They don't remember you. Uh-huh. George Steele is certainly remembered big time, and I wrestled on a stage that I look at now as, when I was wrestling, was family entertainment, but there in the late 80s and early 90s, they become very risque. They had a lot of things that I didn't agree with, fornication in a coffin and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at the wrestling stage as becoming fairly evil, and the stage that I'm on now is the Lord's stage, and it's just, I play off that evil stage with a very positive stage. And I think it was all set up before I even had a clue of what was going on. There's a much stronger force than me.
Does
that make sense?
Oh, it does. It does indeed, George. And I'm just curious, you know, as somebody who communications is my business, so I'm intrigued to talk to you about this here. When you're doing something like this, and you've got you know, your motivational speaking, or as it's also referred to on your website, being a personal coach, would you say that your most effective hook, essentially, is using your own life as an experience? Because you say, again, look at the Lord guiding me through this and this and everything like that. Do you find that that's the most effective, relatable thing for people, is for you to use your own life as an example, connecting the dots of the ways of how you feel that God has been there for you?
That's the only story that I have. Mm-hmm. And I just, last weekend, the weekend before, I spent in a little town near Butler, Pennsylvania, with a preacher and a church that's just wonderful. And they, it's a church that was just planted. And I had a chance to talk to a bunch of people on Saturday night then that were not necessarily the churchgoers. And then Sunday at the church, and my whole story is about the challenges that I faced all the way through. I look at my learning disability, looking back at it and where I'm at now. I just talked to a father from Long Island last night about a son who's 12 years old that's having a real challenge with dyslexia, and the kids make a lot of fun of him because he twists his words and he can't spell or read or write. And I had a great conversation. I told the father a lot of things that will help his son, and in a couple of months after they're ready, I will talk to the boy myself. I didn't talk to him last night. I felt that the father needed to do some things first. But I look at my learning disability as a blessing. And then if I hadn't got Crohn's, which is a horrible disease, and I was deathly ill for 11 years, if I hadn't got sick, I wouldn't have found the Lord. So I look at that illness that I had as a true blessing again. So a lot of negatives in my life has turned out to be blessings, to be honest with you. And I use them when I talk to people all the time. Because If I can't, you know, I'm dyslexic. Do you want to go quote the Bible in verses? Come on.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that. But I can talk about how it's affected me.
That would make it, very difficult. There would be some real challenges to that.
With that said, I've read the whole Bible, but I've done it with a CD.
Oh, okay.
And I follow along, and it reads it to me.
Okay.
So I've done what I can that way, but I'm still challenged.
Sure. But that's great that you've been able to have an aide there to be able to help you do that with the audio for it. George, we always on this show love to give our guests a chance to plug anything. I know that your website is a tremendous base from which for people to learn about your motivational speaking, your message on wellness, anything like that. Please take this opportunity, George, put it out there for the people. Anything additionally that you'd like the people to know about what Jim Myers / George the Animal Steel is going to be up to?
I'm not really doing a whole lot right now. I'm 72 years old. I'm retired. Mm-hmm. God has been very, very good to me. I have a great lifestyle. I go out two or three times a month to speak. But basically, just come to my website. If it can help you in any way, let it do that. If you want to contact me, you can do that through there. But I'm not looking to make money off of anybody. I'm not selling anything, really. I got some old action figures that I bought way back when. They're kind of fun, but you can't get them. There's no place you can find them. Is at my site now. They're sold out.
Okay.
So I own the market on that, but that's, I don't depend on that for a living, believe me.
Well, at the very least, Jim, I can tell that what you are looking for at this point are opportunities to do some good and help spread a good message to people, and I'm very confident that in our audience tonight that has permeated and there's greater awareness, I hope and pray, of everything that you're up to. And I could just say, Jim, it's been a real pleasure to have you on
the show. One more thing I'd like to push.
Oh, please.
And that's the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And you can go to this www.pwhf.org. And this is wonderful. This is it's a real deal. And we've had our eighth induction. It's been around 10 years. It's a real museum. It's not, and it's not a glitter thing. It's just a museum of blast from the past type thing. And my heart and soul is into that also.
George, we had on a previous guest on this show, somebody who I was one, along with you, one of our all-time favorite guests, J.J. Dillon, who I know is very much involved with
that.
Great, great guy. He really put it over strongly, and he recommended, he said, it's not too far from Cooperstown. You want to go to the baseball one there? Swing by the wrestling one when you're at it.
Let me tell you something. It's designed in such a way that we're in the middle of about 14 Hall of Fames.
Ooh.
Boxing Hall of Fame is right down the road. I think it's Glove City or something. It's right there in the area. You've got the harness and horse racing there in what's the town there, just north of us in New York. Then you're not that far from the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
So a person could do a whole tour of Hall of Fames, and I think the farthest one is 180 miles, and that's the one over there, that little one they have in where they play football there, over there at Canton.
Mm-hmm.
So, they could do a whole tour of Hall of Fames, and that's kind of what we're hoping to see happen.
Well, that's great for people to know, and with quality people involved in it, like JJ, like you, obviously it's a very worthwhile endeavor, and I could just say, Jim, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. A thrill as somebody who watched you back in the day. You were a tremendous entertainer. You've got a tremendous story to tell, and I know we'd love to have you back on at some point. It's just been great to have you, sir.
Oh, thank you, and God bless.
Thanks very much, Jim. Jim Myers, everybody, who inhabited George the Animal Steel, one of the greatest characters of all time.